from the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the Closing Market Report. It's the 22nd day of March 2019. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. We'll take a look at the agricultural news for the afternoon and check in with Eric Snodgrass at Agrible. He'll help us explore the floodwaters in Missouri, Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, the Dakotas, and Minnesota, and how those are expanding along not only the Missouri River, but the Red River, the Platte River, the Illinois, and the Mississippi Rivers. And we'll do all of that right here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We're now joined by Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Hey, good afternoon to you, Mike. I want to start in a different space this afternoon. I think you've been watching the macro markets, some of the outside influences pretty heavily. What things boggle your mind most at the moment?
Well, I think, and this is in the context, Todd, that we're coming into a Friday where last week we found out that the managed money positions were record net short futures and options in corn. We've taken the hogs down $20+ since their December highs, now taking them back up $40 roughly since the February lows. And I think that you've got to figure out a reason if you're in the analytical world. At least try why this is going on. Why is the big money, so to speak, the fun money, doing what it's doing? And I really think it has a lot to do with the macro side. I really think it has a lot to do with the currencies and with the spreading and positioning that funds do nowadays, and that correlation that you and I have talked about before. And what we saw this week was the Federal Reserve really turn hard towards the dovish. We're not going to raise rates the rest of 2019. That then followed with some key interest rate cuts. The Russian central bank cut their interest rate. Germany came out with some really rough economic data. Their 10-year bonds went negative for the first time since 2016. What this leads up to is that deflationary pressure I've been so worried about, and it also leads up to the idea that we're going to get into a currency war, especially if the United States and China don't come to a trade agreement. And that currency war means a race to the bottom of cutting interest rates to weaken your own currency to keep your exports propped up, because the world's starting to suck wind as far as the economic fundamentals go and trade goes. So I think this is starting to show through in the trade once again. I was hoping we'd get away from this with the U.S.-China trade deal, and we start to see some good news, and the Federal Reserve would not lead the rest of the world and the central banks down this path, and I think they are. So this is what we have to balance as we see this massive flooding.
Yeah, so this makes things not as bright maybe for livestock and corn and soybean and all ag producers as maybe they were considering, and bright is not quite the right word for, but I think they were seeing an end of this dark tunnel, and maybe it's not there.
I think that's the best way to categorize it, because what we're really looking for is that commodity demand push that turns the funds into longs. And I'll be very blunt with you. I felt 3 months ago that the African swine fever was bad enough. The market shouldn't have gone to the levels it did to the downside. Now it's more than offsetting that. This is the managed money and fund money that is changing the fundamentals for a certain period of time. And so what we're seeing in hogs right now to the upside, and what we saw to the downside in hogs and wheat, I think you might see with what we're seeing in the hogs, the upside we might see in the corn in the next 30, 45 days if we remain very wet and saturated. And NOAA, with their new forecast just coming out Friday, talking about a spring forecast that remains wet in the key river areas, reminds you of 2011, reminds you of 1993. But that, again, is just a weather supply-driven rally more than a demand-driven rally. And I'm really glad, having said all that, that China did step in and buy almost double the amount of corn at 300,000 metric tons on Friday than they were expected to do, and that they didn't wait till April and wait till after the acreage report. So there's still glimmers of hope, but certainly the Federal Reserve was not a good piece of information this week.
So your thought process then surely must be that producers will need to take advantage of this rally, however long it might last when it comes, to sell both old and new crop corn, probably soybeans too?
Yeah, I mean, I would be very reluctant to push very hard on old crop corn, especially as the flooding worsens, because I think your basis is probably going to get weaker, and it's going to get tougher and tougher logistically to get corn into the Gulf. And this brings up the issue of, okay, if China needs corn again, and we continue with the springtime flooding, and it's historic like 11 or 1993, do they have to push it all the way over the Pacific Northwest like we do the soybeans? And does that tack on additional transportation and freight costs? So that's a side note. But my goal is, to answer your question, my goal is yes, 19 corn, get above $900 gross revenue an acre. 19 beans, get above $625 gross revenue an acre. Start getting floors and getting hedges locked in.
For how much production?
Well, in the beans, I'd like to be up to 100% of insured bushels by the end of next week, before that acreage report comes out, because I'm quite sincerely worried, not just about the supply side. And the bean corn ratio started to show this week, of the beans giving way to corn in the new crop. But I'm also very concerned about a hole in the demand for the meal and the beans because of African swine fever.
Hey, we covered a lot of ground quickly. Thank you so much.
Absolutely, brother. Have a great weekend.
You too. That, of course, is Mike Zuzulo. You can find him at globalanalytics.biz. In today's agricultural news, we'll start with how the federal government is and may respond to flooding across the Midwest. The Senate is aiming to vote on a House-passed $14.2 billion disaster aid bill, H.R. 268, when both chambers return from recess next week. Federal aid for flooded farm bill states like Nebraska, which is facing an estimated $1.36 billion in damage, could be in the mix as lawmakers negotiate a final package. The tax writers could also get in on this action. The House Ways and Means Committee is expected to mark up a broad tax measure in April that could include tax breaks for people affected by the 2018 hurricanes and wildfires, and potentially this year's tornadoes in Alabama, and of course flooding in the Midwest. Tax options include allowing deductions for casualty losses, extending tax filing deadlines, easing limits on deducting charitable contributions, and waiving penalties for tapping retirement accounts. The disaster declaration that President Trump approved Thursday unlocked federal resources for Nebraska, where livestock producers are seeking help with replacing ruined feed and washed out fences. So what's next? Well, Iowa is expected to submit its own disaster request to Washington, potentially this weekend. Senator Joni Ernst said Fremont County alone has lost $7 million worth of grain due to flooding, per county estimates. That's money that they'll likely not be able to get back. Grain's not insured in that way, she says. And one final note on the Missouri River, it is expected to continue surging downstream, and that'll cause additional flooding through next week. Government forecasters are warning of a potentially unprecedented flood season. Missouri farmers have also been hit by floodwaters already. Those floodwaters, by the way, have knocked out about 13% of the nation's ethanol production capacity, as plants in Nebraska, Iowa, and South Dakota have been forced to shut down or scale back production following the devastation. Production facilities owned by large companies like Archer Daniels Midland, reports Reuters, and Green Plains were still operating despite days of snowstorms followed by rains that sent record floods into the farm belt. However, with rail lines washed out and corn in storage flooded, production is dropping off, sending prices spiking in markets that buy the corn-based fuel. The U.S. has some 200 ethanol plants capable of producing about 1.06 million barrels per day, and about 100 to 140,000 barrel production of capacity has been taken offline due to the floods, that according to three traders who track the operations. On that note, Growth Energy CEO Emily Score is calling on the U.S. Department of Transportation to help expedite rail delivery of biofuels amid those historic floods. Flooding in a four-state area has delayed transportation of critical supplies of biofuel, which in turn could impact consumer fuel cost. Rail lines in Nebraska, Iowa, and Missouri remain closed, with many washouts reported from the flooding. Those rail lines are critical for the daily operation of biofuels facilities in the Midwest to receive and distribute its products. In her letter to the U.S. Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao, Score said, "Further delays could not only impact our industry, but could also ultimately increase the fuel costs for American drivers." And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
On this Friday afternoon, we're joined by Eric Snodgrass from Agrible. He's been traveling and is in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. You're in the heart of rough country there, flooding, maybe just a little to the north of it. But how bad do things look to you?
You know, when I got in and started driving around, what's really going on right now is most of the major flooding where I am here in Sioux Falls is really tucked away into the rivers and into the drainage system. So in other words, we're not seeing it, you know, spreading widely over fields in this part of South Dakota. Now, still to the south, they're dealing with quite a bit of this in Nebraska. But I'm outside right now. I got short sleeves on. It's in the 50s. It's warm, and we're eroding that snowpack that's pretty far to my north right now. And so we're going to have several warm days leading up to even the middle of next week around 28th, 29th, where it's still going to be quite warm. In fact, I just presented here. I told them you might even see a temperature in the middle to upper 60s by the middle of next week out ahead of our next big system. So, you know, the flood threat is far from over in the major river systems. You know, certainly we are, you know, we're bringing all this water down the Missouri. It's coming down through the Mississippi. It's got to get through the southern tip of Illinois, where it meets the Ohio River. And just as a kind of a side note, I drove over to the Ohio River with my son, my whole family last week, and my son looked out and we went over the bridge and he thought it was a river made of chocolate milk. And I said, well, that's what happens when you put that much water on these bare farm fields. And it looked like class 5 rapids of chocolate milk. And boy, was the Ohio out of its banks. So we're going to continue to see this. Yeah, this flood problem is nowhere near done in the major river systems, much less so when we think about it just widespread across, you know, all the open fields. It's getting better with each day, I should say.
You'd almost hope for the weather over the next 10 days or so not to be that warm, to keep a slow melt going as opposed to something that speeded up. What do you see?
Well, I certainly see we're going to have waves of warmth coming through. So we got a system that's right now coming out of parts of Colorado, giving us severe weather threat to parts of Texas today. It's kind of a slow mover, but it's not a major precipitation producer for Nebraska. It'll get here by late Saturday night into Sunday. It kind of comes across Illinois. Again, not a big precipitation measure, but it is, you know, it's putting down some precip, a little bit of cold air behind it. But then it's next week, we're watching a system coming out of California first. It then goes toward the northern plains. We will definitely be in the warm sector of that storm. And therefore, we're going to get a pretty big warm up around 27th, 28th, 29th. But just because the system is unblocked, really, because we just have a big ridge over Alaska and all the weather systems kind of curl around it, we're going to keep getting, you know, these warm-ups and then a brief cool-down, then a warm-up and a brief cool-down. But I don't see anything like we saw, you know, about a week and a half ago where we have these monstrous winter storms that come running through, you know. So that snowpack, it'll have good chances to be kind of melting away here that's tucked away in northern South Dakota, North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, where there's still quite a bit of water locked up in that snow. So you're right. We're still going to be dealing with it, and hopefully it'll be a little bit slower than a more rapid melt.
You didn't mention any rainfall amounts.
Yeah, it's, you know, when we think about the total amount of rain that's coming, I just looked at a map from the latest European model run, and the rainfall amounts are not like we saw, where we were seeing some folks getting, you know, 2, 3, 4 inches of rain out of that last system, not even close to it with the next few that are coming up.
By mid-April, farmers across the whole of the Corn Belt will be pretty anxious to get into the field. Will temperatures change very much?
Yeah, well, we've got some good news on that front. And the big picture here is that a year ago in mid-April, we were watching a trough that kind of slid back and forth between the Great Lakes and Montana. And that's what kept everything so cold in the central United States all the way through about the fourth week of April, really the end of April, before it finally broke in May. Well, this year, that same trough features tucked north and east of the Hudson Bay, almost to Greenland. And the more it stays to the north, the better we are in terms of recovering normal spring-like temperatures. So I just looked out. Brand new model run came out last night from the European model. It runs out 46 days. It's called the European Weeklies. And the model's in agreement with what we're seeing, which is still an active pattern in terms of precipitation and weather systems. But by that point, we could be seeing the development of a pretty decent southeastern United States ridge with more cooler weather in the southwest. And where that puts us is a lot more closer to average on temperatures, maybe even a slight warm bias in the eastern Corn Belt moving into mid-April.
Turn your attention now to the corn crop in South America, please. Are they still getting rainfall?
Yeah, we are. And the thing is that first crop, remember, was dry finished. The second crop went in early, and they've had really good precipitation, both in in Brazil, where the second crop is growing, but also finishing the first crop in Argentina. So when we don't see these major, you know, problems looking here in the near term, that just tends to tell us that, Brazil's probably looking at another good crop, at least the safrinha crop. The second side of this, though, is that with the El Nino that's coming up, we have basically warmer waters finally surfacing out in the Central Pacific, kind of getting close to South America. That's tend to reinforce the April rain that we get in South America, which will be good for them. But that's also a factor that affects our spring here as well. And if we have an El Nino that surfaces here in spring and maintains itself through early summer, well, we should be happy to see that, because typically those El Nino summers tend to be a little bit better than average in terms of yield, in terms of water, in terms of temperature stresses. But remember, it's a small factor when we look at the whole bigger picture of how all it works.
Hey, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Eric Snodgrass. He is with Agrible.